Good morning. Welcome Summit Church at all of our campuses in the Triangle to what is we consider the first official fall of the weekend. Summer is gone. Fall is here. And there was much rejoicing for that. Let me join with our campus teams this morning in welcoming back all of our college students. Whether you are back from summer break for another year or if it is your first time to the Summit Church because you are a freshman or a new student of some kind, I will tell you, all of you, that we, the Summit Church, is not the same without your presence here in our church. And we miss you desperately when you were gone. So welcome back. Our desire for our college students is that the Summit Church would become your spiritual family during your years in college, whether that's 4 years, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, however long it takes you to get through. So if you are not already connected to a church, we would love for you to help you get plugged in here at the Summit Church. To that end, the first thing that you should put on your calendar, ahead of class and studying and all that peripheral secondary stuff, you need to put on your calendar this Thursday night and join us at the Briar Creek campus for SC United at 7 o'clock. It is a time when all of our campuses will come together, all the college students from the various campuses in the Triangle will be together here. It is going to be a powerful night of worship and a great time to connect with each other. And this might be the biggest draw for some of you. There will be food trucks there, and get this, they will all be prepaid for. That's right. You just walk up and be like, I'll take that overpriced hamburger and I'll take those really bad for your fries and I ain't gonna pay a thing for it. And they'll just hand it to you, no questions asked. My personal motto in college was, if it's free, it's for me. And so I survived in college that way and I turned out fine, so you can do that too. By the way, adults, don't put on like some college-looking outfit and feel like you can just slip in that number. We will know who you are. We can tell. Y'all, listen, there's a lot of great college ministries here in the Triangle, and we are honored here at the Summit Church to partner with many of them. Our main passion is for you to be connected and to get engaged in ministry somewhere. But we do, as a church, we want this church to feel like a home for all of you that become a part of this church. And so for those of you who are wanting to get more connected to this church and to its ministries, this event on Thursday is your event. You could also drop by our Next Steps area at every campus on your way out, and they will have information there about the event if you need that, or just about college ministry in general, and they can tell you all about those things, okay? All right, so welcome back. If you got your Bible this weekend, and I hope that you do, if you'll take it out and open it to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. We are on week number 3 in a series on some of the most controlling emotions in our lives. We are calling this series Smoke from a Fire. It's playing off of an analogy that the 5th century theologian St. Augustine used when he said that our most dominating emotions, our deepest emotions, often function like smoke from a fire that can show us what is actually going on in our hearts. Now, every single week, I've been trying to remind you that for some of you, there's a lot more going on in these emotions than I can deal with up here. These emotions may be tied for you into past traumatic experiences that you've gone through, or maybe they're tied into destructive relationships that you have been a part of or are a part of. They might even be tied into your physiological makeup. And I don't have the space up here to be able to get into all that. For those of you who suspect that these issues might be more complex than I'm able to get into, let me just encourage you to engage with our G4 ministries here at the Summit Church, and that's a great place to start a conversation to go deeper with these things. The first week we looked at depression. The second weekend we looked at anxiety. This weekend we're going to deal with another emotion that all of us deal with to some varying degree, and that is the emotion of anger. Anger, as we know, can be a very destructive emotion and one that is quite difficult to deal with in our hearts. I heard about an elderly couple here at the Summit Church who were talking one evening about the many fights that they had been in over the years of their marriage, and the wife, in just a moment of really humble candor, said, you know, she said, honey, I just admire the way that you always respond so calmly in our fights. I blow up at you and I yell at you and you just respond so calmly. How do you stay so calm when I get so irate? To which the husband replied, he said, oh, it's easy, sweetheart. After you blow up at me, I just go and clean the toilet. She said, that works? He said, oh yeah, because I use your toothbrush when I do that. So there are good ways and there are bad ways. That story's totally made up. There are good ways and there are bad ways to deal with anger. We know that. I don't know anybody who doesn't look back and wish that there were certain things that they could take back that they said or did in anger. It reminds me of one of my favorite Seinfeld episodes, and I know I'm dating myself a little bit there, but Seinfeld episodes where George Costanza calls up some girl and just leaves this horrendous voicemail because he's so angry. He finds out later it was a mistake and he shouldn't have been angry at her, and so the whole episode is him trying to, you know, get to her voicemail before she gets to it so we can delete the message and she doesn't hear it. All of us have had some kind of thing like that. We're like, I just wish I could take that back, or wish I could crawl through, you know, the phone line and pull back what I was trying to say there. Or maybe you sent an email to somebody that you wish you could go through cyberspace and get rid of it before they saw it. Have you done that? Or maybe you copied somebody on the email that should not have been copied. Has that happened to you? We had a pastor here at our church. We actually sent him out to plant a church in Baltimore, and not because of what I'm about to tell you, but I won't tell you his name, his initials, but his name was Brad O'Brien. And Brad was our college pastor, and we were dealing with this ministry that honestly was being really difficult to get along with. And I mean, we're really easy to get along with, and they were being really difficult. And so the guy sent an email to Brad. It was ridiculous. And so Brad forwards it to me, and just, I mean, lets the guy. He just lit him up. He said, obviously, the guy had written it in this like royal blue font. It was really weird looking. And he said, obviously he's using this royal blue font to cover up the fact that this email is nothing but a bunch of doo-doo, basically is what he says to me. So I kind of laugh, you know, at the email. And then I look up in the to line and notice that he has not forwarded only, he has replied all. So this guy got a copy of it. And I was like, oh no. So I jump up and I run down to Brad's office, and Brad is laying face first on the floor, like just spread out. And he's like, I know. And I was like, so, I mean, how do you get that back? You can't get that back. The other ministry was actually really gracious about it, but our relationship with that ministry has never quite been the same ever since. And you've got relationships like that. Most of us can look back and see some relationship that was destroyed or at least damaged through anger. Some of you may have lost jobs. You might even, some of you have gone to jail because of an inability to control anger. By the way, don't make the mistake of thinking that if you're not a person who is prone to violent outbursts, that you got no issues with anger. Some of you are more aggressive in how you express anger, and that means people make you mad, you yell at them. Others of you, when people make you mad, you have more of a passive approach, so you give that person the silent treatment or the cold shoulder. You punish them by removing the blessing of your presence from them, as if you're God, and merely turning your face away is punishment enough from them. And you nurse a bitterness toward them that comes out first usually as sarcasm, either to them or about them, and then turns into some kind of emotional withdrawal from them, where you turn off the fountains of your emotions and you just cease to care. Eventually that can turn into disdain for that person, or maybe even the entire group of people that that person represents to you. Brad Hambrick, who is our pastoral counselor here, wrote out a list of statements that I saw that he said shows us that we are probably nursing anger we may not have admitted to ourselves. Statements like, for example, I'm not angry, I'm just frustrated. Well, why can't I have a bad day without it being a big deal? Oh, and I guess you never make a mistake. Or you're being too sensitive. Or, you know, I'm sick of being the only one who says I'm sorry in this relationship. Or sorry to unload on you, but I just needed to vent. Chances are, he says, if you made any of these kinds of statements, you're dealing with an anger issue that you've never admitted to yourself, and an anger issue that can end up being destructive even in really subtle ways. Now, our focus today is not on the best or the healthiest expressions of anger. That'd be another sermon for another day. Our focus this weekend is on what our anger reveals about the state of our hearts, because that's where the Bible begins. Before it teaches you how to manage your emotions, before it teaches you strategies to cope with them, it wants you to read these emotions to understand what they reveal about what's going on in your heart. Right? And so Ephesians 4, I feel like Ephesians 4 could be written for our society alone. We have an angry society, do we not? And if you don't believe that, just flip on any talk show at night. And over there in CNN and MSNBC, they're losing their minds on something. And you flip over to Fox and they're losing their mind on the same issue, just from an opposite perspective. It seems like people are queued up and ready to be angry, whether they're going into the classroom or whether they're at the workplace or driving down the freeway. People are ready to explode, which is what makes me feel like Paul somehow had in mind American society in the 21st century when he wrote Ephesians 4, verses 26 through 32. Be angry, he says, but don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger, and don't give the devil an opportunity. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. Let all bitterness and anger and wrath, shouting and slander be removed from you, along with all malice. and be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ forgave you. In that passage, I see first a confusing command. Be angry and sin not. What does that mean? We'll explore that. Then I see Paul's answer to anger, which we will unpack also. And then lastly, I see some indications for how you and I can be angry in the right way, which we'll call how to be angry like Jesus. Okay? First, a confusing command, be angry and do not sin. You should first note in this passage that Paul begins his instructions on anger with a command to be angry. Be angry is an imperative. There are times you can and should, indeed must be angry. Some of us were raised to think that any feelings of anger are wrong, but that is not a Christian idea. It is the Buddhists who teach that the annihilation of emotion is a virtue. Christians do not believe that. Rather, the Bible teaches anger as a necessary component of love. Anger is a destructive energy released in defense of something that you love, which might sound bad, but just think about it. When you love the person that is dying of cancer, you hate and are angry at the cancer that is destroying them. And so you release a destructive energy, it's called chemotherapy, to try to rid the person you love of the cancer you hate. If I love my children, I hate and I am angry at things that threaten to destroy them, whether that's physical harm or whether that is a moral cancer like dishonesty or rebellion that I see destroying their souls. If you love the glory of God, then you will be angry at whatever diminishes that or seeks to attack it. Jesus was a person we saw get angry throughout the gospel, sometimes even violently so. He didn't walk around in a sea of tranquility. I know what you had on your flannel graph board when you grew up in Sunday school with Jesus with the serene look and a little glow in his face and his Ric Flair hair floating in the background and his, you know, Superman costume on or bathrobe, whatever it was. He wasn't like that. He got angry throughout the gospels. Mark 3, for example, after he heals the man with the shriveled hand, he discerns that the Pharisees are only interested in catching Jesus break the Sabbath. And Mark, the gospel writer, says that Jesus got indignantly angry with them because they were elevating religious custom over their care for the individual. His anger toward them grew out of his love for him, for the man. In Matthew 21, Jesus gets violently angry at the religious leaders and money changers who basically set up shop in the one part of the temple that was supposed to be for the outsider and for the vulnerable. And Jesus says, you've taken this away and you've used it for yourselves. And so he makes a makeshift whip and he drives them out of the temple. There's nothing in the gospels that indicates that Jesus regretted that later. He never got the disciples together and said, I'm sorry, y'all. I just let my emotions get the best of me. I probably should have used my words back there, and I probably should have been more patient. No, Jesus went to the cross sinless, which means that his anger, even when it caused him to form a whip, was not a sin. Now, just to be really, really clear here, okay? I am not saying that you should drive out people with whips when you get angry, all right? Because you have neither the clarity nor the control that Jesus had. We all clear on that? I do not want to hear something, you send me an email this week about you doing this and saying that I gave you the idea. I'm not saying that at all, okay? I'm just trying to say that if you never get angry, you're not very much like Jesus. If you never get angry, you're not very much like Jesus. The church father, John Chrysostom, was shortly after Augustine, he actually preached at the Hagia Sophia, if you know what that is. John Chrysostom said, it is true that he that is angry without cause sins, but he who is not angry when there is cause also sins. And perhaps to an even greater degree. You should be angry when you hear about the rights of others being trampled on. You should be angry when you hear stories of people being abused by people that they trusted. You should be angry when you see somebody's selfishness and sin destroying their lives and the lives of people around them. In the face of evil, if you aren't angry, you aren't loving. Jesus got angry precisely because he cared so much. So be angry, Paul says, but do not sin. There is a kind of anger that is sinful. It comes from loving the wrong things or loving the right things out of proportion. If anger is a destructive energy released in defense of something that you love, then if your loves are out of order, then your anger will be out of order as well. St. Augustine said that the essence of being a sinner is that our loves are out of proportion. We love the wrong things and we love the right things out of proportion. And if what we love is messed up, what our anger or what we're angry at, it will be messed up also. It is not wrong, for example, for you to value your name and reputation. But if you love those things too much, you will get inordinately angry when your ego is insulted. If you love control, if you love convenience, if you love comfort, then when those things are attacked or they are threatened, you will get angry in response to that. Anger is defense and release of something that you love. Whenever something makes you bad, you ought to always ask what your anger is defending. It's the energy and release of in defense of something you love. So what is it that I love that is being attacked that I'm defending? What's my anger defending? For example, when your teenager comes home late, what is driving your anger? The fact that he or she caused you to lose sleep or to worry is not the biggest issue. Emotionally, you might want to make that the biggest issue because that's how the episode affected you. But the biggest issue is their disregard for rules and what that's doing to their soul. Is that what your anger is focused on, or is your anger focused on the effect that their actions had on you? If I get mad at my wife because she's texting when I'm trying to talk with her, is my anger lovingly motivated because I am concerned with the harm her self-absorption causes to her and those around her? Or am I irritated because I feel inconvenienced that she's not doing what I want her to be doing right at that moment? Right, be honest now. What's your anger directed at that and in that moment? Anybody else get mad when traffic is slow on 540 and those cars shoot all the way down that little ramp and cut in at the last possible minute? Right? Ooh, I get righteously angry at that moment. And I get like 2 inches from that bumper in front of me. I'm like, you're not cutting in here, right here. And I feel totally righteous in that. Now, is that a righteous anger or is that a selfish anger because I'm being inconvenienced? Here's why I know mine's not a loving anger. Because when I'm the one that's shooting down that ramp as far as I can get, I'm like, I got places to be. And these people should understand that. And they should just let me in because I got stuff to do. When you get mad at work because your contributions were not recognized, is your anger fueled by a love of your own praise, right? I mean, do you get just as angry when credit is withheld from other people? That's the same moral corruption, but it probably doesn't anger you as much because it didn't trample on your own selfish desires. The point is our anger becomes problematic because our loves are out of order. And that means the way that we deal with disordered anger is by addressing the disordered loves that fuel it. The way we deal with disordered anger is to deal with disordered loves first, which is what Paul is going to turn his attention to. So number two, Paul's answer to unrighteous anger is to put on the new man. You might notice that Paul's whole discussion of anger here, his whole discussion of anger comes as a series of commands. Commands that honestly, when you read them on the surface, seem impossible. For example, Paul, verse 31 commands us, let all bitterness, anger, and wrath, shouting and slander be removed from you, along with all malice. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving one another. To somebody who is really angry or really hurt, that seems like an impossible command. I mean, how do you just stop? How do you just turn off an emotion? Stop being bitter. Start being happy. Stop being hurt. Start being compassionate and forgiving. You know, whenever I talk about forgiveness or anger or these kind of things, I've learned that there are three different kinds of people out there who really struggle with what I say. The first kind who really struggles with it is the person who knows they ought to forgive, but they just can't work up the courage and the strength to do it. The second kind of person who really struggles with what I say is the person who feels like if they forgive, they'll be letting the offender off the hook. And that just feels like it's minimizing the injustice and it feels wrong to them. Like it wouldn't be right to give that person forgiveness. The third group that really struggles claims to have gone through the motions of forgiveness, but memories and hurt and anger keeps coming back into their heart, making them wonder if they've ever really forgiven at all. So the question is not, what do these commands say? The more important question, I think, is how do you develop the ability to actually obey these commands? Well, see, that's where it helps to consider that these commands are all part of a bigger section in Ephesians, starting in verse 24, in which Paul is telling us that we got to put on the new man. Put on the new man, which means that we need to begin to live in the new reality that Christ has created for us. Paul hints at two elements of this new reality that enable us to get rid of unrighteous anger. The first is at the end of verse 32. He says, forgive one another, just as God also forgave you in Christ. If you're taking notes, I want you to write that down in a phrase that I hope, if you've been at this church for any amount of time, I hope is very familiar to you. Number one, you write this down. We recognize that we are first sinners and only secondly sinned against. That's a phrase I've explained to you was first introduced to me in a marriage counseling session that my wife and I had gone to because we were both angry at each other. You know, we've been married for a couple of years and I was angry at all the ways she was disappointing me and things she wasn't doing right. And she was angry at me because all the ways I was disappointing her and things I wasn't doing right. And so I spent a half hour telling the counselor about my side of it. And she spent a half hour telling the counselor about her side of it. And the end of it, the counselor looks at us and says, the problem with both of you is that neither of you really seem to understand or believe the gospel. Which is a bold thing to say to a pastor, by the way, okay? He said, you don't understand the gospel. He says, both of you are talking as if you are righteous, perfect people and the other person has sinned against you. He said, that's probably partially true, the latter part, you've been sinned against. He said, but you seem to have lost touch with the fact that you are first and foremost a sinner that has been deeply forgiven by God and only secondly are you sinned against. And there is nothing that your spouse has done to you that compares at all to the way that you have done treated God and what God has forgiven you. That doesn't change the injustice. It doesn't mean that what that person did was not wrong, but I promise you it will change your perspective to that person in that moment of injustice. Now, let me be very clear. What I don't want you to do with that statement, first sinner, second sin against, is to use it to beat your spouse over the head with. What are you complaining about? You treated God way worse than I'm treating you right now, okay? So first sinner, second against. Remember, do not do that, okay? I don't want an email about that at all. It is something that you use to apply to your own heart where you say, you know, I realize that yes, this person may have wronged me and I'm gonna have to deal with that, but I realize that I am first and foremost a person deeply forgiven and I can't ever get over that. And that just changes how I treat those who have sinned against me. It means that I approach any situation deeply aware of how much I've been forgiven of. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was the German Christian who was martyred in World War II, said that he often saw this in Christians in church when they would really start to get serious about God. He said, you know, especially new Christians, they would always come to a point where they got disgusted with everybody else in the church and all the hypocrisy and inconsistency. You know anybody like that? Maybe you are that person, okay? By the way, maybe you're at home listening to this on podcast because you just can't bear to be in church with all the hypocrites and all the inconsistencies, right? So you're just at home with you and Jesus and your little glory circle there. So he said, well, I got good news and bad news when you get to that stage. Good news, he says, you're growing in Christ. We know that because you're becoming more sensitive to sin and it bothers you. He says, that's good news. Bad news is you're only at stage one in your spiritual growth. He said, stage two, a much more important stage, is when you become more disgusted at your own sin than you are everybody else's. He said, that's stage two. He says, stage three, the most important stage of the three, is now you're ready after going through stages one and two to re-enter the church. This time is not as a self-righteous Pharisee who is there to condemn everybody else, but a broken sinner who has received grace and is ready to help others find the same grace that you have found. It means that when you understand how deeply you've been forgiven, it just changes your perspective to those who have weaknesses and sins and are sinning against you. Paul gives the second element of this new reality at the end of verse 26 when he says, don't let the sun go down in your anger. You would write this down simply as, it means we've resigned as judge of the universe. Not letting the sun go down in your wrath means I don't have to carry with me to bed the burden of righting all wrongs. When the sun goes down, I'm not thinking about it because God is the one who rights all wrongs, not me. God's promised to do that. That means I can lay my head down on my pillow at night and I can just go to sleep. Paul only alludes to this here in Ephesians 4 with that quick little phrase, don't let the sun go down in your anger, but he really unpacks it in another place where he talks about anger. By the way, if you want to get into varsity level Bible study, Paul's a preacher, which means he's got like 10 topics that he talks about, and he just, you know, talks about them at different times in different letters, but it's the same stuff. And if you really want to see something fascinating, look at where he just like quickly introduces it in one letter, but then really unpacks it in another. So he introduces it in Ephesians, but to the Romans, he just kind of unpacks this concept. So if you're super fast with your Bible, flip over to Romans 12 or scroll down to Romans 12. If not, I'll just put it here on the screen for you and I'll make all your dreams come true here, okay? Romans 12, he says, repay nobody evil for evil. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. By the way, this is Paul's acknowledgement that sometimes it's not always possible. He's got in mind here that there are certain relationships that, for example, are abusive. And he's not saying you just stay there and take it. There is a time that it's no longer possible to live peaceably and you have to remove yourself from the situation. By the way, if you feel like you might be in that category, we wanna help you. Come to us and let us help walk you through that and we want you to be safe. He's acknowledging that there's a time when the best thing to do is remove yourself from the situation. Regardless though, he says, verse 19, Beloved, never, whether you stay or whether you go, never avenge yourselves, never. You gotta leave that to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to eat, drink, for by so doing, you'll heap burning coals on his head. By the way, I love that phrase, because you're like, well, that's exactly what I wanted to do to my enemy. I wanted to heap burning coals on their head. So talk to me here. Well, you notice this is a quote. He's quoting from Proverbs 25, 21. That's a Jewish metaphor, heap burning coals on their head. And what Paul meant when he used that was heaping burning coals would have one of two effects. Number one, it could wake the person up, right? You know, hot water, cold water, either one will wake a person up, you know, out of their slumber. He's like, by doing kindness, you might actually change their heart and wake them up to the stupidity and the wickedness of their injustice towards you. And that in that way, you'd be overcoming evil with good. That's one thing. The other thing that might happen is, as you continue to do kindness to this person who is doing you evil, right, and they don't change, God in heaven is just taking notes. He's just writing it down. And what Paul is saying is, on the day that comes when God brings vengeance, all that kindness that you did to them is gonna be like more hot coals of judgment that are coming on their head. God's gonna be like, really? After all this person did to you, they responded to you this way good, this way good, this way, but you did this and this and that. And it's gonna make it that much worse for them on the day of judgment. Either way, the point is, either way, I don't have to carry around the burden of feeling like I'm the one that's gotta make things right, because God promises to carry that burden. You see, I know for that person that wronged me, one of two things is true. Either their wrong toward me is gonna be paid for by the death of Jesus Christ on the cross, where all my wrongs were paid for, or this person is gonna pay for those things they did to me eternally in hell. Either way, I don't have to carry around the bitterness that comes from feeling like they're just gonna get away with it and my score will never be settled and my cause will never be taken up. And because of that, see, I can show grace. I don't have to carry around the burden of judgment and vengeance, because there is a faithful God who promises to execute it, and I can show grace, which again, is just gonna do one of two things to that person. It's either gonna be like hot coals waking them up to the absurdity and the wickedness of their injustice, which is awesome, or it's going to just increase judgment on them in the final day. Either way, with the injustice, we can make like Elsa and just let it go. I can let it go. I don't have to deal with that anymore. By the way, one of the charges the world likes to make about Christians is that because we believe in a judging God, well, that makes us judgmental. People like Bill Maher say this, like, oh, because you believe in a God of judgment, that makes you a judging evil person. Let me just quote here from Miroslav Volf, who is a survivor of the Croatian genocides. He's now a professor up at Yale. Miroslav Volf says, only a spoiled Westerner like Bill Maher, who's never actually suffered injustice, could make a statement that stupid. He says, when you have lived through genocide like I've had, and you've watched your mom and dad, brother, sister, raped, beaten, murdered, oppressed, the only thing that could keep me from going insane with rage and bitterness and just consumed with the desire for vengeance is the knowledge that there is a just God who holds vengeance in his hand and will settle all scores one day. He says that is the only thing that releases you from bitterness. And he said even more so, it actually gave me the ability to begin to forgive, to begin to love, and to start that process of healing. Right? It is believing that God holds judgment that releases you from bitterness. Releases you from bitterness. When you try to take on that role of judge, see, it's going to corrupt you. That's why Paul says that letting the sun go down on your wrath just gives opportunity to the devil. Right? It's like putting on that ring in Lord of the Rings, you know? You're like, my precious anger. Right? Did y'all like that imitation? That was pretty good, wasn't it? Anger is not in the original. I added that. So my precious anger, I just nurse it. See, you weren't designed to be judge. For one, you got your own sin. And those who deserve to be judged have no right playing judge. Secondly, reason you're not designed to play judge is when it comes to wrongs done against you, it's just impossible for you to separate personal offense and personal selfish anger from righteous and loving anger. So instead of getting vengeance, what happens is it ends up corrupting and destroying you. Trying to play judge over wrongs done will just corrupt you. Which is why Paul says, turn over your anger to God as the sun goes down, and you can trust him with final judgment. Know that it will be executed, and you can live free of bitterness and hate. Now, one quick caveat before we move on, because people have this question. When Paul says vengeance belongs to God, he does not mean that there should be no courts or laws or justice. In fact, Paul anticipates that objection in Romans 12 and goes on in the next chapter, Romans 13, to say that governing authorities are God's means, his first wave of protective justice on earth. On earth, he's committed the first wave of his justice to the governing authorities. We have laws and courts that are supposed to be as impartial as they can. And most are set up to try and be impartial. And y'all, I know it's not not a perfect system. And I know that we got a lot of work to do in correcting it and making it more fair, but it is a system that is ordained by God. And it is God's first wave of protective justice here on earth. So he's not saying to do away with courts and government and police. What he means is that individuals should not carry the burden of obtaining ultimate justice for themselves on earth. God will see to that, so we don't have to carry around that burden. So Paul's answer to unrighteous anger is put on the new man, which means live in light of the reality of the gospel, which means first that you embrace that Christ has forgiven you of far more than you're being asked to forgive somebody else of. And then secondly, that you trust the sovereignty of God and you trust that he's got ultimate vengeance and you can leave that to him. All right, so that's Paul's answer to unrighteous anger. So now, let's spend our last few minutes considering what this loving anger might look like in practice. Because in this passage, Paul gives you a few hints at what loving anger is. We'll call this section number three, how to be angry like Jesus. Letter A. We see that loving anger is redemptive, never vindictive. It means it's directed toward the problem, not the person. Here's how Paul says it. Let no corrupting talk. By the way, corrupting in Greek means tearing down. Let no tearing down talk come out of your mouths, but only in anger, when you're angry, only what is good for building up. In my angry confrontations, I'm not trying to execute vengeance. I'm not trying to tear down. I'm not trying to pay myself back. I'm not trying to make myself feel better. My goal is building up as fits the occasion that it may give grace to those who hear. I want to do with others what Jesus did with me, which is remove the evil from that person while saving the person. That means you confront the person's wrong, but you're doing it without the slightest drop of malice or desire to make that person pay or to make yourself feel better or to get vengeance on them. That means that confrontation about their evil should not feel like a venting of frustration. It should not feel like an execution of justice. It ought to feel like an invitation to restored fellowship. Jesus had the greatest analogy for this, but one that admittedly very few people I think really understand. Matthew 5:39, he said, when somebody strikes your cheek, give them the other one. And people were like, what does that mean? Like somebody's attacking you and they're trying to kill you and you're just like, you stand back up, you're like, I'm still standing. You stand back down and you just keep doing this until you can't stand anymore. No, that's not what Jesus meant. First of all, the person that is striking your cheek is not trying to kill you. In Jewish thought, the face represented the relationship, okay? So when someone is striking your face, they are insulting the relationship. Right? And no martial arts textbook says, if you really wanna hurt somebody, go for the cheek. Right, that's not, it means that they are threatening to destroy the relationship. So what do you do in that moment when that person has sinned against the relationship? Well, you got three options, right? Number one, you can strike their cheek back. That's what we all wanna do. You smack me, I'll smack you back. You smack me, I'll smack you harder. We'll end this that way. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. That's one option. That's the aggressive way of dealing with it. The second way is passive. You offer to them the same cheek, right? You're like, you kind of stand up, you're like, all right, here it is. You know, you just keep taking it, and you take it, and you take it, and you take it, and you take it. Until, you know, you eventually just shut off all emotion for that person or eventually you blow up at them. That's not what Jesus is saying either. The third option, the one he is saying, is you turn the other cheek, watch, which includes a confrontation about the wrong because you struck my cheek and that can't happen. But I'm turning my other cheek, which means in the midst of confronting you about the wrong, I am re-offering to you the relationship. I'm offering to you the benefits of restored relationship. And so that confrontation doesn't feel like a venting of anger, doesn't feel like an execution of justice. It feels like a loving confrontation where I'm trying to restore the fellowship between you and me, trying to eliminate the sin and draw close to the person. Does that make sense? Loving anger is not vindictive. It's restorative. It's redemptive. Letter B, loving anger is short-lived. Loving anger is short-lived. Paul gives us a test for this one. Whether or not the sun goes down in your wrath is a test, listen, of whether your anger is selfish or loving. Whether or not the sun goes down in your wrath is a test of whether it's selfish or loving. Loving anger is always short-lived. You confront the person for the wrong they did, and then you commit the injustice to God, and you let God deal with them. And then you get to go to sleep an unburdened person, and the sun has not gone down in your wrath. Selfish anger, by contrast, oh, it stays with you. You lay down in your pillow and you just start mulling over the injustice and the insult and nursing the sting of that wound and replaying the conversation and what you wish you'd have said and what you might do to get that person back. And it just lays there and you simmer with that anger. When my wife and I got married, we tried to put this whole don't let the sun go down on your anger into practice. We're like, okay, well, that means let's never go to bed until we have everything resolved. All that did was lead to a bunch of sleepless nights, right? Because here was the problem. We would try to talk about whatever the issue was, but even after we did, I would still be angry because she didn't see it my way. After pulling out the best lawyerly arguments I could come up with, she still didn't see it my way. Or if she did see it my way, I'd feel like she's not nearly sorry enough, right? Uh-huh, that's right, she wasn't sorry enough. I didn't get that tearful confession I was looking for where she weeps at my feet and says what an awesome husband I am and how lucky she is to actually have, because that's what I deserved and that's what I wanted, right? Right now, she is feeling the same way, like I didn't see it or her way, or I didn't apologize enough, I didn't feel bad enough. This verse is not talking so much about resolving all your issues before you go to bed, although that's a good thing to try. Instead, it's talking about, listen to this, the attitude you take into your disagreements. And that attitude is, I don't have to carry the burden of settling the score. I don't even have to carry the burden of getting her to see things my way. I can confront the wrong, then I can go to bed and leave vengeance and her to God. How long your anger lasts reveals whether it's selfish anger concerned about personal vengeance or if it's loving anger concerned with the other person. If it's loving anger, you're confronting the wrong and committing it to God and trusting him to take care of you and defend you. If it is selfish anger, then you're gonna mull over it and the sun is gonna go down in your wrath and it's gonna stay with you, not for a night, it's gonna stay with you maybe for years. Y'all, Jesus's anger in the Gospels was always short-lived. You ever notice this? Hey, here's the best proof of that. Matthew 21, I learned this week. Matthew 21, after Jesus drives out the people from the temple who are, you know, buying and selling things with a whip, he was angry, right? Right after, literally the next verse, after he does that, the next verse, verse 14 says, and then all the lame and the sick came to him. In other words, all the vulnerable got close to him. Is that what happens after you're angry? Do all the lame and the sick and the vulnerable come around you? Or that, ooh, don't get near that person, right? I mean, it means that Jesus wasn't angry. The lame and the sick were like, ooh, stay away from Jesus this afternoon. He is in a mood, right? When he left the temple, he cursed 5 different fig trees and they all withered right there. He passed to the food court and turned the wine back into water for everybody. He was angry. Just stay away from Jesus. No, immediately it was done. It was surgical. It was directed at something and immediately this love just reconsumes him, so the vulnerable flock to him. Is that what happens right after you're angry? Which leads to letter C, loving anger is controlled. Verse 31, when he tells us to let all bitterness and anger and wrath, shouting and slander be removed from you along with all malice. He's talking about avoiding that state where you feel consumed by anger. Whether that comes out aggressively through shouting or passively through slander, either one of those is your passive and aggressive way of responding. Either way, you are just gonna ignore that state or get rid of that state because loving anger develops slowly. The book of Proverbs says a lot about anger. In fact, I considered doing this whole sermon out of the book of Proverbs, but let me just summarize all of Proverbs' instruction about anger could pretty much be summarized as this. It doesn't counsel no anger, it counsels slow anger. Proverbs 29:11, a fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. Which means when that person calls you and says, I just needed to vent. You say, proceed, fool, okay? Proverbs 29:11. Chapter 16:32, he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. You're slow to anger, it means you've got more power an ability to change than a mighty person with all the resources that they might use to change. Proverbs says that being quick to anger rarely has a good effect. An angry person just stirs up more conflict. A hot-tempered person commits many other sins. Or the book of James, the New Testament equivalent to Proverbs, James says, be slow to anger. Be slow to anger. For the anger of man does not work the righteousness of God. Whatever change you're wanting to bring in that person, almost guaranteed your anger is not going to produce that in them. What produces the righteousness of God in people is grace. And so when you give grace, that's when you produce the righteousness of God, but the anger of man does not work the righteousness of God. So rather than quick and reflexive outbursts, Proverbs counsels us to respond with patience and gentleness. It says a soft answer usually turns away wrath. A lot of times you diffuse a situation when somebody's angry at you, you just speak a soft word back to them, but a harsh word just stirs up more anger. Or you get the next verse, Proverbs 19:11, it is one's glory to overlook an offense. Sometimes the best thing to do with a wrong done to you is just to let it go. And that's your glory. And it will diffuse a lot of anger. Probably 80% of the rude things that your spouse says to you in marriage, you do not need to respond to or confront. Loving anger is controlled and it is slowly developing. That's what God is like, right? I mean, throughout the Bible, he's always described as being slow to anger. Moses' great description of God, God is slow to anger. I've told you in Hebrew, the phrase that we translate slow to anger in Hebrew is literally long of nostrils, which is like confusing to people. They're like, what is being slow to anger got to do with a big nose? Well, I mean, think about it for a minute. What happens when you get angry? Think anthropomorphically here for a minute. You start to breathe, you breathe out and your nose starts flaring and all of a sudden you're like a bull ready to go. But that's if you got a little old nose. But if you got a big old nose, it takes a while for those nostrils to get flared. You got to get more worked up, right? And what it's saying is that when it comes to anger, God's got a big old nose. God will get angry. He will get angry, but it takes a while. And that's how you should be too, because that slowly developing anger is how the righteousness of God ends up being produced in people. So when you are angry, that means, yes, you ought to close your mouth and breathe deeply through your nose and say some, you know, serenity phrase like goose frabau or whatever you got to say, but you ought to let that develop slowly. You say, well, how do I know when it's better just to let it go? How do I know when I need to respond? I don't know if my anger is loving or selfish. How do I know the answer to these questions? I'll tell y'all that this is an emotion, maybe even more than the other two, that you've really got to process in community. See, you know when you're depressed, you know when you're feeling anxious, but usually when you're unrighteously and destructively angry, you're the last person to know it. But other people can see it. And this is the kind of thing that a small group is supposed to be able to say, this is not healthy. This is not helping. This is the kind of thing that ought to be processed in community. So see, what Paul has done here is he's shown us the difference between selfish anger and loving anger. And he's shown us how to develop loving anger and to rid ourselves of selfish anger. Let me close here with one final thought. I want you to think for a minute about how much better a place the world would be, how much better your life would be, your relationships would be, if this is how you approached anger, if this is how our world approached it. Think about how much conflict and strife would be avoided. And by the way, don't just think about your own relationships, how much better they would be. You need to understand how much better your own heart would be. What God is giving us here is not an impossible command. What he's giving us is freedom. You see, bitterness, the worst casualty of bitterness is not the person you're mad at and you're bitter at. The worst casualty is you. I've heard that, you know, keeping bitterness or keeping unforgiveness in your heart is like trying to punish somebody else by drinking a cup of poison. It's not going to hurt them nearly as much as it's going to hurt you. Nursing bitterness and resentment gives Satan the tool that he needs, like Paul said, to destroy and corrupt your heart. A few years ago, I read this book called The Bishop of Rwanda. It was about the genocide in Rwanda that took place well over a decade ago. And the Hutu people in Rwanda had risen up to oppress and to murder the Tutsi people. And there was a Tutsi bishop named John Rusihana, who after the conflict had died down, was appointed by the government to be a part of a council that was to bring healing and restoration to the country. And so as they're working on restoring these relationships that have been damaged by years of oppression and murder and rape and pillaging, Bishop John Rusihana said one of the most profound things on forgiveness. He was addressing the whole nation, but in particular the Tutsi people that had been so wronged. He said, one of the most destructive lies that Satan uses to destroy our lives, listen, is that we've got to wait until the person who wronged us properly repents or feels sorry enough before we will forgive them. Jesus did not do that, he said. Jesus forgave from the cross. Forgiveness, he explained, is more about releasing you from the bitterness. Getting rid of resentment and bitterness is more about your relationship with God than it is your relationship with that other person. It has to do with whether you understand that vengeance really does belong to God. I don't have to carry that burden. And whether I approach the whole question and the whole situation as somebody who's been deeply forgiven and cleansed. When you forgive someone's injustice, you're not saying that what they did was not that bad. You're not letting them off the hook. You're just acknowledging it's not my hook that they're on. It's God's hook. And God's hook is a whole lot more holistic and a whole lot more thorough than my hook ever would be. Y'all, and that is freedom. Some of you have harbored bitterness for so long, it's eaten away your soul like a cancer. You've become just an angry person. You're angry at people you've never met. It's impossible for people to please you because you've just got this years that have been there and you feel like everybody owes you now. A lot of what you're angry about now, it can't even find resolution anymore. I mean, parents, how do you pay back a 25-year-old son for the years that you weren't there for him? If it was your, how do your parents pay you back if you were the one that was wronged in that situation? They can't. And if them bringing proper restitution to you is the condition for you to get over your bitterness, you'll never get over it. You're a prisoner. How long are you going to be a prisoner to people that you don't even like? People who aren't even in your life anymore. How long are you going to let people who are not in your life and maybe aren't even alive, how long are you going to let them control your life? You got to stop living in the past. You got to stop nursing the hurt and telling sad stories and trying to get people to hurt with you and coming to some catharsis that way. And you got to take responsibility for your attitude. Yeah, I'm not trying to minimize your pain. I'm not trying to say it wasn't that bad and just get over it. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that some of you are captive to that bitterness. And I just want to tell you, there is a way out. And that way out has more to do with your relationship with God than it does your relationship with that person who wronged you. You're going to have to trust the sovereignty of God, the fact that vengeance belongs to Him. And then you're going to have to embrace the forgiveness of Christ, and you're going to have to rest in His judgment of the universe, and you have to rest in His provision for you. Forgiveness and release of anger has more to do with this relationship, the vertical, than it does the horizontal. Now, when you've fixed this, when it certainly will lead to conversations in the horizontal with those who've hurt you. Peter once asked Jesus, if you've been in church, you've ever heard this story, but Peter once says, Jesus, Lord, how many times do I need to forgive somebody? And then Peter suggested his own answer, seven, because seven's, you know, Jesus' favorite number, obviously. By the way, when Peter asked that, I have to wonder, like, what number was Peter on in his own mind with this person? Like, number six, he's like, just one more, Jesus, and then I'm going to go Old Testament on that guy, right? And Jesus' response, right? No, Peter, not seven, 70 times seven. Now, a little Hebrew math at work here, okay? It's not that Jesus was saying 490 is your key number, at 491, then you can go Old Testament. No. Seven was the number of completion, but 10 was also the number of completion. So Jesus was saying, I need you to forgive completely, times completely. And then he threw in another seven factorial just for whatever. I need you to forgive completely, times completely, plus completely. In other words, Peter, it's got nothing to do with this person, how many times they wrong you. It's got to do with me. It's got to do with you trusting me and you learning to say vengeance belongs to me and I can respond with grace the way that Jesus responded to me. There's a way out. There is a way out. And it's found this way. Why don't you bow your heads with me if you would at all of our campuses, bow your heads. First, if you receive the forgiveness of Jesus, some of you have been hurt and deeply wronged. I understand that, but Jesus came to earth to die, not just for that other people's sins against you, but for your sins against God. And the release of bitterness starts with the receipt of forgiveness. Have you ever embraced Christ's forgiveness for you? If you have, you want to re-embrace it. Ask God to make it real to you. It's the fount from which forgiveness flows. If you've never received Christ's forgiveness and you would just say, Lord Jesus, I know that you died for me, and I receive that right now. Now, here's the second question. Can you right now say, God, I trust you with vengeance. Vengeance belongs to you. I don't have to get resolution. I'm gonna let that be your thing. I'm just gonna rest in your judgment. Can you turn that over to Him and walk away from it? Can you resign right now as judge of the universe? Say, Lord, I'm gonna let you take care of, and put the name in there, that person you're angry at. I'm gonna let you take care of my boss, my wife, my husband, my mom, my dad, my friend. I'm gonna let you take care of that. Now, can you choose right now a choice to extend forgiveness to whoever that person is. They may be years ago, it might be something from earlier this weekend. Can you say, I choose right now to forgive? By the way, it very likely might lead to a phone call as soon as we get out of church where you call somebody and just let them know. And it might involve you confronting the wrong in them, saying, this hurt me, but I want you to know that I want to restore the relationship and I choose to forgive. It might involve you asking for forgiveness for the bitterness you've held against them, or maybe you're the one that did the wronging and you just need to say, I know it's going to take a while, but I want to start this process because I want to remove the evil and I want to love you. Father, if there were ever a time when we needed the healing of Jesus, if there were ever a place where your promise that if we came to you, that you would release us of our burdens and give us rest, it would be in this area. God, I pray that you would saturate us deep in the gospel. We would rest in the mighty name of Jesus and we would find release from bitterness and resolution for anger. I pray in Jesus' name.